the Brother, Brother, Brother podcast. I'm your host, Wyndham Lewis. I am here with my two brothers today, Christian Lewis and Jeremy Sartori, and we are talking about what we're listening to. As usual, that encapsulates music, movies, TV, anything culturally relevant that we are concentrating on right now. So let me throw it out to both of you quickly, or I'll throw it out to Christian first. What are you listening to?
Yeah, well, a lot's happened since I think the last time we were on the pod just a few weeks ago. So we had the Oscars, which got us all talking about the same handful of movies and finally cranking through the last sort of half dozen that I guess we hadn't seen. So we'll definitely want to, devote a segment to that in a little bit and talk about one or two of the favorites that we had. I think we can also talk about some pretty good TV out there. I know that I've been watching Shogun and really enjoying it, because who doesn't want to get absorbed in 16th century Japanese politics, like palace intrigue with zero context or help. But I'm really digging that show. And then there are a bunch of great new albums that we wanted to go over. So maybe we can kick it off by talking about one that I know we all really, really love on first listen, which was the new Waxahachie album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tiger Blood. Jer, hit it. You're the big Waxahachie historian. You're the one that's been in there the longest.
The Waxahachie.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been torn for years with Waxahachie. I just think it's another like really solid... I mean, I think Katie Critchfield has obviously become kind of a staple in the songwriting department and made a shift an album ago to go a little more back to her folk or country or Americana, whatever you want to call it, roots, and successfully so. It was a huge album for her. But I think kind of starting in, like, you know, Ivy Trip and Out in the Storm, she's just a really, really, and probably before that as well, with albums, but just a really solid songwriter. And I think the only thing that's really kind of changed around her is both her, you know, getting a little older and having some life experiences that seem to have been positive, like getting sober and things like that. And then, you know, just less crunchy, loud guitars and swapping that in for kind of more of a full band approach or full sort of player approach, Nashville sound kind of thing. And this album in particular, I love the last album, but I think benefits a lot from having a band that she played with, MJ Lenderman, who is in Wednesday and has solo stuff that we really like. And then, I don't know Jeff Tweedy's kid's name. Is it Spencer?
Spencer
Tweedy. Spencer Tweedy. Drums and a few other people. And I think, I don't know if you guys heard this on this record, but Christian, I don't think you were as big a fan of the last one as Wynn and I were, but it sounds...
No, that's what sort of turned me. I mean, go ahead, but I'd say I missed out on the Sarah Lee and Salt era, and I've since gone back to it and fell in love with it as well, but it was like her, I guess, 20s, was it the... pre-COVID album, or was it the one that came out at the beginning of COVID?
St. Cloud,
St. Cloud, which was awesome.
Yeah, I think we were championing that, and you were like, I'm not there yet, and then you got to there.
Gotcha.
Yep, it was just a question of, like, locking myself in, you know, my apartment for the weekend for, like, spring cleaning or something, and coming out and just being like, holy shit, you know, I'm a changed man. It's, you know, it's one of those sort of discovery projects that, like, once you hear it or once you figure it out, and, you know, I think it doesn't suffer for anything, but I think the critique I probably made 2 years ago or 3 years ago, if I'm giving myself a scorecard, was that I would have said it's too slow and I just can't I can't get into it. But I think, you know, the musicianship is outstanding. All of the choices that they're making, that she's making about, like, arrangement and sort of how, like, songs build and just keep building and keep building, I think is awesome. then, like, you know, she does have a great voice, and uses it in kind of an interesting way with, like, holding notes for a lot longer than you know, any instrument is playing a particular melody or whatever, and, like, she's kind of this, like, driving force through a song that, like, creates continuity between sections and stuff. I think it's super cool. But also just, like, MJ Lenderman, great guitarist, great backup.
Yeah, great. Yeah. It really works.
So I think he's a cool addition.
And then, yeah.
I kind of like her voice paired with somebody else, as I've realized.
I think
as well, too.
Yeah, and some of the earlier stuff, which would have hooked us in, I think, you know, just because it was pretty indie rock sounding, but, like, also had her sister singing a lot of backup, too, and other people. And that was one thing that I was missing a little bit on St. Cloud. Cause she packs a lot of words into, you know what I mean? She packs a lot of lyrics into a phrase, and but does it in a way, like, it's kind of instrumental. It's cool. But I thought his subtle sort of, like, laid back delivery really works on this album.
It's hard. It's funny. It's hard for me to imagine who, like, he wouldn't be a good backup singer for, or, like, within the genre, obviously. Like, I don't know that he's a
vocalist,
like a rock singer as much, but, like, he's
I like his solo stuff.
But in like a folk Americana country, yeah, I do too. I really do. We were all fans of his solo album last year. It's just, I think he's got a great delivery, and contributes a lot. Who was the other album, the album that Katie Crutchfield released?
Oh, with Jess Williamson. Yeah. Planes.
Yes, thank you.
And Jared and I went and saw her in about a month ago.
Yeah, it was good.
And she was terrific. And did one of the best covers, most surprising and best covers we've seen in quite a long time. Started at the Sinclair in a half full room, which she still, you know, owned very thoroughly. And she closed with Still the One by Shania Twain.
Yeah, it was great.
Kind of kick ass.
Nice. Yeah, she's cool. She's got some, she's weird. Yeah. It's basically, it's like, that's definitely the raunchiest, like, Christian rock album
I've ever heard
or something. It's like very sort of, like, it just, you know, throw it on in the background, and I guarantee we'll do a couple of double takes. Because you're like, did she just say?
did she just say fuck me in a southern drawl?
Yeah, like, it's a little confusing, but pretty funny. So, anyway, I think, you know, I'm going to be, like, playing this through the turntable this year, I think. It's such a good one to put on.
It's not a dud, which is nice. It's just a straight through album.
Yeah.
Take it easy, honey. Catch me towing the line. Lost in a role I play. Stuck in a video game. Armed with a safety pin. Overly confident. My skin is airy thin. But my game is rigged to win. I keep my head up.
Yeah, I think, and that sort of brings us to one of the other albums that just was released. And I think still, I mean, if I'm not reading the general public properly, forgive me, but I still don't think a lot of people have discovered Hooray for the Riff Raff, Linda Seguero's phenomenal band. And I think this is album number eight or, you know, it's getting up there.
It is. I think so. The Past is Still Alive is the new Hooray for the Riff Raff album. It is... I think really just an outstanding record end to end as well, and actually pairs very nicely if you're looking for two things to listen to in sequence on like a long drive or something. I would highly recommend checking out Waxahachie and then this record.
Again, I saw Hooray for the Riff Raff maybe a year or two ago.
Too, right?
And again, yeah, very, very light attendance, but fantastic. As you can imagine, living in a place like New Orleans, you have a sort of Murderer's Row of musicians, and that band really kicked ass. And she was fantastic. And again, was very keen to play an arena ready set for a half empty room. But it was, I was shocked at how few people were there. And you know, so if we can spread the gospel, let's do it.
Yeah, this is another really solid album. I think a few years back, Christian, you maybe turned at least me onto, maybe both of us, The Navigator. And I haven't gone back much past that, but I love that record. And then Life on Earth was a huge one for us in 22. And I'm like looking at her discography or whatever you call it these days, her albums. And I forgot, like, Small Town Heroes got a lot of hype too. She's definitely a critical darling, but I agree. I think, like, hasn't quite broken out. And I don't know if it's, this is like a weird kind of take, but like she has an aesthetic of something that doesn't really seem like she's going to sound the way she does. She's pretty straightforward, you know, singer-songwriter when you listen to her music. And it's interesting. It's got, like you said, good players and good hooks and things like that. But she almost, you know, looks like a gutter punk, you know, when you take a look at her in terms of, like, just style and kind of, like, you know, definitely like an artist.
Well, right? Like, you know, describes her history as, like, train jumping and like, dumpster diving and shit. And I think it, you know, that kind of stuff, like, I'm sure it alienates plenty of people. You don't have to look very hard for, you know, for people who are looking for reasons not to listen to things. And that's, you know, that's too bad. Because what you have is a really, just an incredibly, like, reflective, thoughtful, poetic, like, songwriter here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's what she does so well.
Great
she
voice.
Stories.
Yeah, great voice.
Yeah.
And she kind of hit.
Yeah, matched with a voice that's seen some shit, so to speak.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a kind of gravel or a rasp, or there's something in it that it just, I'm sure she has always sounded this way, but it's like, you know, when you hear a 19-year-old, it sounds like they've been, like, smoking for 60 years. There's just, like, some people have it, some people don't, or some people can summon that when they sing, and it really does, it does go nicely with a certain genre that has sort of ageless storytelling.
Well, her songwriting, too, I was going to say, is, like, you know, as you get older, you kind of stop assuming that every song is about somebody that's singing it, you know, or about their life or romance or whatever, and her songs tend to have, like, what sound like, you know, who knows, but pretty personal stories of some, you know, hard luck and some, you know, characters that, like, you know, clearly are loved, but in sort of the danger zones of life in terms of drug addiction and things like that. And it's just, I love when you can kind of catch a story. It reminds me a little bit of, like, Lucinda Williams and stuff like that, where she's a really good songwriter.
Very much. I don't think, you know, neither she nor Katie Crutchfield are very shy about their love of Lucinda Williams.
No, so. Definitely not. Should we listen to something?
I was going to say, let's take a quick break, and what do you guys want to throw on from one of these two new albums?
I think we throw in a little Hooray for the Riff Raff, because it's a little less widely listened to. First song on the album.
Some recent music that I've been listening to and enjoying, new stuff, and probably get into some television for sure and some movies. But Wynn, this is a band that you sent out to Christian and I, who is I don't think gonna have any troubles with press or hype as they're kind of, you know, hitting the world with storm by storm and getting a lot of nice write-ups. But awesome band, Freako from Chicago, Illinois. Give us stumbled onto them.
F-R-I-K-O. I just, you know, it was as simple as reading a review and being like, that sounds like something I would like. I think we're hopping in the way back machine for this segment, and this one takes us back kind of to the early 2000s, I think. It's funny, we all started, you know, listing references when we first heard this. I thought it was like a sort of cross of a little bit of Ezra Furman, a little bit of Arcade Fire. I know Christian and you were thought there was some Conor Oberst in there, but it's just good tunes that build. And I think Jared and I are going to go see them coming up, I think, in April here. And they're still not even headlining smaller clubs.
I feel like this will be the last time they're an opening act on this tour.
I would think so. I thought
this is the first album by the band, right? Yeah, I think that's worth mentioning, just because they're not, they don't have a touring base yet even.
It's
fresh out of
looking at stuff. Empty Bottle Shoebus for sure. And I think that is kind of where they kicked off. But I think they've built pretty quickly because they looked like they were selling out the Metro, which is probably like the equivalent of here at least it'd be like the Roadrunner Club, the new one or something where it's bigger.
or Webster Hall.
Webster Hall in New York or Williamsburg or whatever. And I think this band's going to get pretty big pretty quickly, I guess. I don't know. Maybe there isn't an audience for this as much as I think there is. But I hear Radiohead. I hear a lot of different stuff. And I just got to say, too, like some of their songs, like I like the whole album in particular, but then there's a few that really just catch me, like the Get Numb to It song or something, where it just has a lot of like even Elephant Six stuff going on, or they kind of shapeshift but still sound not like they're doing a cover album by any means.
There's a lot of music coming out of two people would be one of my observations. Like I found it sounds, and I think partly it's because of how much like sort of range and like stylistic breadth the lead vocalist Nico Capitan covers. He can be a lot of different people at once, and it has an almost operatic is maybe the wrong word, but it has that
theatrical
kind of, theatrical like presence, right? So it's actually not unlike the lead singer Geese, I think I mentioned a band that we talked about a few years ago on the podcast, Active Bird Community, where I don't think it like has quite the same complexity maybe, but where it has like you have a really captivating lead singer who's doing a lot of the musical work, and then like you only have one or two other instruments, but it really feels pretty filled out.
Carrying a lot of the melody.
When you learn that it's a small number of people,
Yeah, I think there is a third touring member who does, sing a good amount of backup. I thought they were going to kind of explode out of South by Southwest, but I thought they would have been this year's sort of model actress.
If they were doing like AI panel on South by Southwest, they may have, but I don't think music is quite truly the focus there anymore.
No, it really isn't. Jay-Z showing up to rep Apple with Tim Cook or something. But I thought they would kind of be the darlings of South by Southwest. We're seeing them open for a band called Willis. And very much looking forward to see what the live set looks like. I've seen some clips and I'm optimistic. is Freako, and I urge everybody to listen to them. But Christian has disappeared down another
Laurel Canyon.
Again, we're hopping in the time machine. Yeah, he's tumbling down the hill at Laurel Canyon without brakes, and he has discovered.
I'm having a 2024 is a year of music consumption that I would say Wyndham Lewis had in 2021
or 1977. Yeah.
Well, yeah, possibly, but listening almost exclusively to female artists so far this year.
Yeah.
I think we were up at our friend Paul's place last weekend, bankrupting the Massachusetts state lottery, with our Keno winnings and hanging out at Spirit House Records, and we started talking about, I mean, I think, you know, we always have fun making the playlist for those weekends with our buddy Paul, but I think a Linda Ronstadt tune came on, and I ended up going down the road of listening to her first two solo albums, and they've just been on like constant replay, and really wearing out the record player this week. So I guess just a little context for the uninitiated, as I was. She came onto the scene in like the late 60s with the Stone Ponies.
Which was her hometown band.
You know. Yeah.
Tucson.
Yeah, Southern California.
Tucson, Arizona.
Tucson, Arizona.
Okay. And then moved to LA.
Got it. And that was, and they were largely covering songs by, you know, everybody from, they were writing some of their own. So it was Mike Naismith and Tim Buckley. Were the Stone Ponies.
Is Jeff Buckley's dad? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And Mike Nesmith from the Monkees.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And then she sort of broke out on her own with two albums before she hooked up with the backup band that comprise basically the members of the Eagles. So, you know, there's this 1970 to 72 kind of interlude where she makes two very, I would say, pretty traditional country albums. And she's kind of, she's had a little bit of time on stage. The public know who she is. These are the first albums that are being billed under her name. And of course, she goes on to have just a massive career, but also a widely a sort of iconoclastic and like varied career in terms of being unafraid to, you know, try very kind of unusual genres and put out entire albums and styles that you know, record executives would shit a brick over. So it definitely has this sort of eclectic taste, but what I really want to talk about are the two albums. So one from 1969, Hand Sewn Homegrown, and Silk Purse, which came out in 1970. And in this first one, like, as I said, it's, you know, she's sort of leaving the California sound behind. It's obviously, it's soaked into her voice, but she is making a fundamentally like Nashville album. And she, you know, changed producers to Elliot Mazur, who then spent the next 10 years working with Neil Young, and really just like is trying to make as traditional a country record as she can, and it comes out like awesome and weird and very ahead of its time. I think, because, you know, it just, there weren't those kind of cross, like California, Nashville crossovers with the DNA of one, like sort of dressed up in the style of the other at that point, right? Like you got it in the other direction with the Birds. But I think taking the Californian and putting them in Nashville was kind of was a pretty unique sound. And so I think like Bet No One Ever Hurt This Bad is just like an incredible song. oddly written by Randy Newman. But it has this sort of cool, like, groove and swing to it that like is a great just match with her voice. So anyway, I would go deep on these two records. Silk Purse, I think, got more acclaim probably.
There's a very good documentary that came out about 3 years ago called The Sound of My Linda Ronstadt : The Sound of My Voice. That I would highly recommend if you're looking. She has a pretty interesting background. I mean, she was from Tucson. I believe her dad was Mexican and was a musician as well. She then, you know, as Christian just mentioned, her backing band at one point was the Eagles. You can hear her and Stevie Nicks and I believe Nicolette Larson maybe singing backup with Emmylou Harris on Graham Parsons' In My Hour of Darkness. I mean, she was, of anybody, I think she kind of embodied the spirit that a lot of people profess to have, but were a little too egotistical and greedy to actually carry through out in the Laurel Canyon days. I think she was a true collaborator and really liked working with other people. I think the fact that she mostly sang, you know, other people's songs was part of that. She didn't have the ego wrapped up in you know, authorship, and I think you know, all in all, not to mention the fact that she was probably my first crush when I was you know, 7 years old. I thought she was, you know, the most beautiful woman in the world, and so, you know, I've been a long time Linda Ronstadt admirer and a huge fan of her music. She does go on later to do, I think, a big band record, a Tejano, or, a Spanish language record. She did an album. I think, didn't she do an album with, like, Dolly Parton at one point?
More recently, though.
Yeah. Right? Well, I mean, more recently being, like, the
80s. 1990.
Or maybe, yeah. I mean... It was you know, to me that seems recent. To you guys, that's ancient history.
But she also had what's interesting here, and what I don't think we've mentioned is we've talked about her Laurel Canyon era, and then we've talked about her like sort of later collaborative era. But there was like a time in like the back half of the 70s, and
she was a rock
first
star.
Half of the 80s. Right, she was billed as like. Or, you know, described as the highest paid woman in rock.
Yeah, she was.
Yeah, and she did all that in a Cub Scout uniform. I don't know if you've ever seen that footage. She sold out Dodger Stadium and performed in a Cub Scout uniform. Nice. So,
yeah,
she also like seemed Budokan to be like, you know, there's so much of that like era had so many issues later on, like Jackson Browne, and obviously the Eagles have a pretty long, gross history, but. I don't know. I mean, was there a lot of controversy around her when I would ask? Because I never...
None.
Yeah, I don't know.
Next to none.
Yeah, it's weird.
I mean, you'll see the documentary, the Eagles approach her mid-tour and say, hey, listen, we're going to start our own band and we're leaving the tour. And she's like, hey, best of luck.
Yeah, cool. you guys will do great.
You know, she just seems like the nicest person.
Yeah.
She currently lives in the Bay Area, I believe, and unfortunately has been stricken with some health issues that have rendered her unable to sing any longer. So
yeah, I was going to ask.
I think she's pretty reclusive.
I heard something. She had like a throat thing or something.
Yeah.
She has Parkinson's.
Yeah, it actually makes her a little bit difficult even to talk. Mm-hmm. You know, her vocal cords have been, I think, somewhat injured by whether it's this a particular disease or whether it's just, you know, wear and tear over the years. But, you know, all in all, just a really remarkable person with a remarkable talent who seemed like she did it for the love of doing it, love of music. So, three cheers for Linda Ronstadt. We're going to take a little break and come back and talk about movies and TV.
Sounds like good advice, but there's no way.
and I think I'm gonna love you for a long, long time.
Welcome back to the Brother, Brother, Brother podcast. We are doing a What Are You Listening To episode, and that includes anything, books, movies, television, blah, blah, blah. What are you listening to on your TV, boys?
So, maybe, all right, if we're going to do an Oscars run, I will submit for your consideration. Let me just throw out a few names, just so that we like, can decide where we want to start. I know we all want to talk about Zone of Interest, I think. Probably the holdovers. I think we've kind of done Oppenheimer, but you know, could revisit it.
Barbenheimer.
Know about the end of the year. Yeah. Barbie, Killers of the Flower Moon, Poor Things, Maestro, An American Fiction, which, Jared, I remember you said you really liked.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you see it?
So,
I mean, I think we talked a little bit about, maybe we didn't, but I feel like we talked about holdovers, Oppenheimer, Barbie, and
yeah,
Flowers.
The one I do think, and I just want to mention it, I don't really care too much about discussing it, but the one I think that was criminally overlooked that I thought was really excellent was May December.
Yeah, you love that
the
one.
Todd
I
Haynes.
I like May December. Mm. And the other one too, Past Lives, I thought was, it wasn't overlooked.
Yeah,
it was really good.
And I should also mention Anatomy of a Fall, only because the lead in that is the same as Zone of Interest, which is a hell of a debut year on
at least for
American cinema.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean,
Anatomy d'une Chute.
I think we were kind of, I mean, after years of what seemed kind of like there were some good movies, we got spoiled this year with a lot of good movies, and there's really only one or two I didn't care for, and it wasn't for lack of performance or anything like that. It just wasn't my thing, and was not a fan of Poor Little Things, but she was great, and I get why she won the Academy Award.
Yeah.
I think in the end,
the
ones that stuck with me were, I mean, I think we all love the holdovers, like we talked about, for particular reasons. Big Pain fans, and just the story, Alexander
Payne,
the
director.
And Joel, both, you know.
Yeah.
And parental neglect
feeling,
is a very familiar feeling.
Yeah.
But I think for me, Zone of Interest, American Fiction, and actually Past Lives were the ones that kind of touched me the most, and or at least like stuck with me. I think Zone of Interest, I felt like I had gone through something, like it was traumatic, and I needed to talk to somebody afterwards. And it was
totally.
I remember just begging, like, you know, maybe you guys to see it at some point, because I was just like, oh my god, that movie's.
Well, that was a thing. I remember you.
So let me ask a question first of all. American Fiction, like I've only seen the trailer for it. Is it like too much of a stretch to say that? Is there like a Paul Beatty inflected kind of story?
Oh yeah.
Here, or is that
absolutely
okay?
I mean, Paul Beatty.
It's him specifically, or
no? It's Percival Everett, who wrote the book. Called Erasure, and that book goes back to 2001 or 2002, I think, which is, you know, very, very much planting the seeds for The Sellout. Paul Beatty's phenomenal book. Percival Everett has a new book out now called James, which is a retelling of Huckleberry Finn through the eyes of Jim. And it's supposed to be fantastic. He wrote The Trees a few years back, which was shortlisted for the Pulitzer, among other things. I mean, he's fairly prolific and an incredibly impactful writer, and who finds the whole fucking thing absurd. And I couldn't agree with him more. He's a pretty interesting cat. I think he teaches at USC now.
Where would you recommend starting?
I'd say Erasure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really, you know, it's, check out the movie. I think the movie's really good. I think the trailer is a little misleading. I think it looks more farcical than, I mean, it is farcical, but it is...
It's sort of two movies in a weird way.
It is two movies, and I like the other movie probably better.
I'm with you, yeah.
The family drama, which I think is just amazingly lived in, and...
it's just really well done, just
disarming and funny.
Across from Jeffrey Wright, who was nominated for...
Sterling K. Brown.
Best. Did he win?
No.
But
he's
he,
great.
Okay. In a perfect world, he does. Yeah. Leslie Uggams plays his mom. Tracy Ellis Ross plays his sister. And then I was unfamiliar with the woman who plays his love interest. Apparently, she was on a long-running and beloved TV show.
It's a flawed movie. It's definitely not perfect. And I think,
it's not perfect.
Yeah, and I think the trailer... But, I mean, whereas I kind of feel like the holdovers was, you know? And I know movie's 100% perfect, but that was pretty close. And I think the trailer does kind of... It totally kind of threw me off, actually, the first time I watched it. And I was like... It was a little conflicted as to, like, huh, it's not what I was expecting, you know? I mean, that's there, for sure. But it's just not... It's disjointed in that sense. But I actually... It's another one that, like, the more I thought about it, I really liked. And just it's exactly what Wynn said. So it'd be interesting to see what you think, Christian, when you see it. Because I'd say the other movie, to me, was kind of the movie that I really enjoyed. Which isn't helping much in this conversation, because you don't want to give it away.
I love Jeffrey Wright, too. So.
Yeah, and I thought it was a great family drama.
Yeah, I agree.
Or comedy drama, you know, it was both. It was, it's just the parts that are reaching for comedy may be a little bit overkill, but the parts that are subtly funny are fucking great.
Yeah.
And then, Zone of Interest, which not as funny.
No. The trailer isn't really quite.
This is not something that you can segue into, unfortunately.
Yeah.
This is something that deserves a
solemnity,
a break before and after. Or maybe a moment of silence. I think it's one of the most gripping, engrossing, like hard to watch but impossible to look away movies I've ever seen. I think, and like it's. You know, occasionally I talk about, like, being reminded that directing is a job within the world of making movies, because it's like, I'm not as, like, as much of, like, a film guy as you both are, and I have no concept of, like, how things work behind the camera, and so for all intents and purposes, like, I sit down, watch a movie, and it's like what I see on screen is the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And like, of course, there's a massive production and like massive, you know, it's like so many meticulous decisions go into like every little thing. But this is one of those movies that takes me out of that because it forces me to consider the directorial choices. It's one of the few movies I can remember sitting there watching every single credit go by. And looking at like the name of every single person who worked on the production, because I like was curious, you know, just all the like the smallest details were given so much care.
Mm-hmm.
I think, out of obviously respect and sort of a desire to show you something that is as close to a documentary as it could possibly be, while also being sort of lightly dramatized. But I think the most powerful piece of it is the mundanity of it.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a real hard trick to pull off.
Yeah, but every table setting mm-hmm. has to be perfect. Historically and regionally, and like you can't have any distractions where people can say, oh, well, why did you make this choice or that choice, or you know, it's like I didn't. We recreated a still life effectively to show you exactly how fucked up this would have had to be.
No, I think Jerry saw it first, and if I'm not mistaken, you saw it at home, right?
Yes, I did, yep.
I did too.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater, and yeah, it was like by myself, and you know, I had the same reaction Jeremy did, which is somebody else needs to watch this because I need to talk to somebody else about it. It's arresting. It is, you know, I can't say enough about it. I think it is by far the best movie I've seen in quite a long time. You know.
So there are maybe like two or three like sort of maybe questions I wanted to pose to you guys. The first one is, how do you pack that much narrative and story into a movie that has relatively, I would say it's like, it's a short script.
It's a short movie, right? Really. And for this day.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Jeremy said that.
And you're a fly on the wall.
Yeah, Jeremy said that to me when he saw it. He's like, there's not much dialogue. And the fact is, there's plenty of dialogue. It's just, there isn't much story.
Right.
You know, there isn't much action. There isn't, but there's, you know, people are talking throughout. It's just that they're not really like talking about the thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the cleverest thing I've seen in a long time. And obviously there's
maybe it's the
over the wall.
Sorry. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I want to grab onto that point before it passes. I think it's the fact that the story doesn't drive, or rather the dialogue doesn't drive the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story is like the entire interior life of the local Polish woman who's the nanny, who's an alcoholic, who doesn't have but three lines. Who is, you know, drinking in the nursery like overnight and just getting like blind drunk because, you know, because living next door to this place like drains you of your soul, right? Like it's that's an entire story that doesn't get a single word. Like, and there are two dozen of these.
Well, there's the mother
and
grandmother exactly. that comes to visit. Who
yep.
is so, and, who does get deeply affected by it and leaves.
That's it. It's every single person, like is a real person whose life you contemplate within the confines of like the four, you know, walls of the screen.
Well, I think that you know,
it's somebody who you have to imagine existing and get. I think sort of in the grander scheme of things, like. What this movie does is, I mean, among other things, it helps. It's telling a different part of the sort of bigger picture. Like,
yeah, it's inexplicable. Really,
how do you tell the history of an atrocity like that? And the answer is, well, the first thing you need to do is hammer over and over and over again the criminality, the extraordinary violence, the lost life of the victims, and then this is doing something completely different. It's like what's not said is more powerful than what's said.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Turn the other
and
eye.
I think
you have
that,
a blinder,
you know,
on
I heard
the whole time. You're watching it.
I heard the term that I heard a lot when I was first reading about this was the banality of evil, and that is what this is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a
also one of my favorite literary terms ever, mm-hmm. which was a Henrik Ibsen term, which was Werfensdung's effect, appropriately German, which is the process of alienating an audience from themselves. So you suck an audience into a story, you get them to feel a certain thing about the characters, and then you essentially peel back or reveal things about the characters, or they already know these things, perhaps. Mm. For instance, you're learning about this family and you're thinking, man, they have the same kinds of problems that every family has, or like they have the same kinds of like marriage disputes that other people have. And it's like, oh wait, but these are also mass murderers. Like, And so it is precisely that, like, juxtaposition that is so riveting, but also, like, it just makes you feel fucking icky.
Yeah, there are the moments where it is explicitly discussed, or, you know, at least referenced, and they're very few. You know, obviously there's the meeting between the commandant and the you know, engineers. And then there's that one not very subtle but really affecting moment where the two boys are playing outside, and typical, like, bullying kind of older brother, younger brother kind of thing, and he locks the brother in the greenhouse and then just goes psst, like imitating, you know, the sound.
Yeah, I'm your guard.
Yeah, it was just fucking freaked me out. And
because you, it's like you watch, yeah, it's just seeing in real time.
That's
like
how they're playing cops and imitate. Robbers. Yeah.
Yep.
That's how they're playing whatever. I mean, it's just, and that, it just, there's, you know, again, it's just so, I just, everybody should go see it. It's, or that's everybody great. Should see it. It's just,
it, yeah, it's going to stick with you.
Hmm. How do you segue out of this?
You don't. We'll just stick with it for a minute, because there's another thing I want to ask about. I had dinner with a friend the day after I saw it, and of course was still talking about it. And his reaction was kind of that he felt like he was watching a movie at MoMA, which was maybe the closest thing to a criticism that I could imagine hearing. But he was like, yeah, it was just a little too, like, there were some, it was just too directed, like, and
who was his friend?
First of all, I wanted to ask you guys, yeah, what's the correct, like, vocabulary for what he's trying to say?
It's art direct, you know, there are very distinct choices about, you know, the visuals, you know, much as the holdovers, which I think I will begin and end my comparison between the holdovers and Zone of Interest here. But, you know, Alexander Payne shot the holdovers with vintage equipment, I believe, or at least, you know, and even at the beginning of it has the old, like, rated R, you know, MPAA symbol come up, and you know, so it feels like it is a movie from the 70s rather than a movie about the 70s. And you know, Zone of Interest makes very deliberate choices about, you know, it does look like a storybook of sorts. It does have a lighting that is, you know, is extreme, and
well, and it's, you know, you'll have very broad shots,
but also does, like, look, like, know, it's of that period. Panoramic. It looks like the color cinematography of that era, and I, you know, I don't know enough to delve deep into the choices that were made, but it does not feel like a lived in, worn in kind of feeling. It feels very arresting from the first shot.
The three other quick things I want to mention. One, the choice to use like a red out in, you know, one of the screen transitions was
three of them. Yeah,
I thought very unusual.
You forget by the end of it that it, I mean, and this is very much emphasized by seeing it in the theatric, or seeing it in a theater. It begins with about 4 minutes of just drone and blank screen.
Yeah, so the I don't know if Micah Levi did that port, did the sound tracking of,
I believe,
or
so,
sound effects, which I would assume that is, but she certainly did the music, which was very sort of deranged in a way, like, it just, it, you never, you, like, you, it never felt comfortable. I think, but the infrared camera was also, like, a pretty fascinating incorporation, and I think in Jonathan Glazer's now much like, or you know, I don't want to say it's necessarily controversial because but what has become, or you know, it's certainly attracted a lot of controversy, his speech at the Oscars, but he mentioned, you know, he dedicated the movie to I don't know whether he said the character or the young woman who glows on screen as Off. And so I wonder if it was a real historical figure.
I have no idea.
Or simply a symbol of, you know, the sort of resistance and support network. But yeah, that was sort of the first and only time I've heard anybody describe what we're sort of why it was done in that particular way. Mm-hmm. But it was just such a fascinating like choice.
Mm. Yeah.
And then the last thing I wanted to ask about was, so Martin Amis wrote this.
Yeah. That's weird. Mean, that is shocking.
I had no idea until like,
is the book credits. Called Zone of Interest?
The book was called Zone of Interest, okay. I believe. And I don't know who wrote the script. I can't remember. Was it Glazer?
Jonathan Glazer.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, just for like what the canon of Jonathan Glazer is stuff. Currently the Jamiroquai music video, Sexy Beast, and Zone of Interest.
Yeah. And Under the Skin.
Yeah, but and one other just like.
Yeah, he's an eclectic guy.
He's good.
Welcome back to Brother, 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 where today we were talking, what are you listening to? We're going to end this podcast the way that we end every podcast, by putting a song on the playlist. Jeremy, what do you want to add to the playlist?
I'm going
to
go back to 2006 and the great, I think Portland, Oregon-based punk band, The Thermals, and Pillar of Salt off their classic, The Body, The Blood, and The Machine. I happened to actually have lunch with Wynn this week, and I popped that on my T-Ride. And then I stumbled into a bar yesterday, and the same song was on, which was great. So, love The Thermals.
That's
and,
awesome.
Wynn, Christian, how about you guys?
That's weird.
They rip. They were such a, like, I love somebody who sings at, like, full tilt desperation every second.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like Mac from Superchunk in there.
Definitely.
Yeah, or a little Ted Leo, even. I mean, it's like... Somebody just the veins are fucking popping out of their forehead the whole time.
Tightly wrapped skull.
it's a great one. How about you, Wynn?
I'm gonna go with a classic from the Britpop era, and that is "Something Changed" by Pulp.
Nice, that's a great song.
Awesome, and I think I will put on. Long, Long Time by Linda Ronstadt.
Sweet. I think it's going to hurt me for
this
a long,
was a good
long
one.
Time.
We'll come back soon, and we can talk Shogun and maybe do a little TV episode.
Sounds good.
And
have
some
a good one.
P. Diddy updates. Talk to you soon.
Bye. I'm Wyndham Lewis. On behalf of my brothers, Jeremy Sartori and Christian Lewis, thank you very much for listening to the Brother, Brother, Brother podcast. Many thanks also to our heroic producer, Damian Kendall, and to Simon Doom for our epic intro music. Learn more about the pod at brotherpod.com. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and it's extremely helpful if you rate and review us on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.